So we have recorded for us in the first four verses of Daniel chapter 1, the first deportation of Jews to the city of Babylon. Now there are going to be other deportations that occur. You may remember Nebuchadnezzar's come down to Judea, and he has removed the king, and he has made Jehoiakim king over the people. And in doing so, he receives thus the loyalty of the king of Judah and the people of Judah as well. Now, he hasn't destroyed Jerusalem at this point in time. Jehoiakim, a few years later, is going to rebel, and Nebuchadnezzar is going to get angry about that. He's going to come back and besiege Jerusalem and the walls of Jerusalem for about a year and a half, and finally he's going to tear those walls down, enter into the city, and just absolutely destroy everything that's left. And so you've got a couple of more deportations of the people that are going to occur. But as of right now, Judah still does possess a little bit of independence. Jehoiakim's the leader, and the people are still inhabiting. However, Nebuchadnezzar's come in, and he's kind of taken the best of everything, some of the temple treasures that we read about in verse 2, as well as some of the young people that were there. Now, if you stop and you think for just a moment, compare the Babylonian captivity to the Assyrian captivity. When the Assyrians came in, what did they do with the nation? What did they do with their enemies?
They scattered them.
Okay, now you contrast that with what Nebuchadnezzar's kind of doing here. What's Nebuchadnezzar doing differently than what most of the nation's powers would be doing whenever they would come into a nation? He was bringing and incorporating the very best of that nation into Babylon to use and to benefit from their intelligence and their wisdom and their power and their gifts. Unlike the Assyrians, when they came in, they would just destroy and pillage and plunder and kill and murder. Nebuchadnezzar, he's trying to win the loyalty of these Jews and incorporate them into Babylonian captivity. You know, you stop and think. We talk a little bit about Daniel being a young man. How old do we think Daniel was whenever he entered into captivity in the city of Babylon? Okay. Now, what language here as we read through this? You look at the king's command, Nebuchadnezzar's command, when he says, take some of the nobles and the king's descendants, and he says in verse 4, young men. Now, if you've got the King James Version, your version may say children. That Hebrew word children means one born or one recently born. Now, it's not referring strictly to young children or babies, but we would stop and we would kind of look at the culture. The Persians, around the age of 14, would begin instructing their youths. That's when their formal education would begin. So we look at the language here that's used in the book of Daniel regarding Daniel and his friends who were taken captive, and you kind of look at other cultures around. 14 seemed to be the age around when formal instruction began. So it's likely that whenever Nebuchadnezzar sends his people in to retrieve some of the young men from the land of Judah, that they're around the age of 14 or 15, as Tommy said. So it's likely that Daniel and his friends were around this age. You stop and you think about that. That's a very influential time in a young person's life. They're going to be very susceptible to learning. And if you think of perhaps these young Jews versus someone who was older, who perhaps may have had more wisdom and more life experience, they'd be more resistant to the changes and the different cultures and the different things that they had faced in the city of Babylon. But you've got Daniel and his young friends who are at an age where they're very impressionable, where they're very teachable. And so it's likely that reason that Nebuchadnezzar wanted the young people from the city of Babylon, from the city of Judah, brought to the nation of Babylon. And, you know, it's not just any young person. He gave some very specific characteristics. That brings us to question 5. What are some of the unique challenges that Daniel and his friends would face in Babylon? Now, I know we may have gotten off track, and we may have lost our questions because those have been back there, I think, close to a month. So, Mr. Bonner, you can find the answer for that in verses 3 and 4 if you don't have that. Would you mind answering that question for us? And by the way, if anyone needs the questions, we're more than halfway through, but the questions that we've used and the questions that we'll proceed with, there's a few copies in the back. We were out and I printed off some more this morning. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's true. And you, obviously that wouldn't work very well with Jehoiakim, but you go back and you read about Jehoiakim, he was a very self-absorbed individual. He didn't care about the people. Remember, he was the one that added on to the palace whenever his people had things that they needed. He didn't care about the needs of the people. He cared about his living arrangements, and so he builds on to the palace. A very selfish man, very corrupt, very evil. So in that particular instance, I don't know how much good it would have done. And you consider later, 3 years, Jehoiakim's going to ultimately rebel against Babylon. And he's going to be taken back and forced to live in Babylon from that point forward. But it's true, they could have taken advantage and used that to kind of hold that over the head of some of the people. You've got some of your children, so don't act up, don't rebel, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, make sure you pay your tribute and everything will be okay. It's possible that they could have done something like that. So we come to this question. Why don't we just open it up for a discussion? What are some of the characteristics?
They read a while ago, the language there, don't do their food and drink that
require. Okay. So he pretty much wanted the best and the brightest, didn't he? Just in a nutshell, that seems to be. He said one of the things that they needed to have was they needed to be without blemish. That is, no obvious mental or physical imperfection. Now, there have been some ancient cuneiform texts that have been discovered that have spoken of the individuals that would, on behalf of the king, on behalf of Nebuchadnezzar, intercede in a divine way, working as a diviner or something to that effect, and they were required to be without physical blemish or without mental imperfection because they were going to seek out the future and determine the will of the gods and those sort of things. And so it's possible when you think of the service and the way, the capacity that Daniel and his friends are going to serve, it's possible that that could be why Nebuchadnezzar said they don't need to have any blemishes because they're going to intercede on behalf of our gods for us. So that could have been part of the reason why. Fast learning, he wanted intelligent individuals, and he wanted them to be able to be trained in the language of the Chaldeans. Now, we've mentioned in our introduction that Daniel's written in what two languages? Hebrew and... okay, Aramaic. Aramaic was somewhat the diplomatic language of the Babylonians. However, they did speak a language that was more unique to them. That's Akkadian, or also called Neo-Babylonian. And it's likely the language of the Chaldeans wasn't the formal diplomatic language that they were going to be taught. Rather, it was the Akkadian language that they were going to be taught so that they could communicate with the Babylonians in their native tongue. And so, this is likely the language that Daniel and his friends were going to learn and were going to be taught was the language of the Chaldeans, that is, the Akkadian language. Okay, I think we already, and I guess I skipped, I didn't go far enough ahead. That was actually the question that we answered, that Buster answered just a minute ago, the characteristics of those who were deported to Babylon.
In fact, the children part of it, those four that are studying here,
mm-hmm. Right. But at the same time, there have been people that have placed Daniel and his friends up in their 20s because they would say, well, no one that young, 14 years old, 15 years old, could have developed the faith that Daniel and his friends demonstrate, or later going to demonstrate, in dealing with Nebuchadnezzar and being incorporated into that heathenistic society. But I think that that's just a problem that this generation struggles with, the previous generation, and maybe even the one back is, parents aren't placing responsibility and expectation upon their children. And, I agree that they weren't babies. We're not talking about 2, 3, 4, or for that matter, probably even 10 or 11. I think we're 14, 15, 16, something like that. We're dealing with teenagers, I imagine, Daniel and his friends. But the faith that they have to be able to stand up in the midst of this turbulent society and this culture shock and away from mom and dad and their influence is impressive. And I think that we need to try to instill these things within children who are young and who are at home and who are impressionable to help them, just like Daniel, like you say, develop a strong faith in God. Bill, were you going to? To a certain degree, I would say it was God's providential work. You know, you see God frequently involved in the book of Daniel. I mean, you look at the verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim into the hand of the king of Babylon. You know, and God's going to perpetuate His word, and He's going to make Daniel make all of these various prophecies and all of these teachings and all of these dreams and visions known to Daniel. So I'd say very much God's hand was involved. Now, in the providential sense, that King Nebuchadnezzar went and selected some of the best, and that Daniel and his friends, who had a strong faith and were receptive to God and His teaching and His law, that they ended up over there. And you're going to see again in chapter 1 and verse 9 how God is very involved in this process with Daniel and his friends. So absolutely, God was involved and God was at work. Good point there. Any other comments, questions? Absolutely. Right. And, you know, we talk about God and God as being sovereign. That is, God being in control of everything. And it's kind of like Dave says, God has got a plan. God's plan is going to be accomplished. We just have to determine, how are we going to fit into God's plan? Are we going to be, it's kind of like Paul in the New Testament talks about, you know, are you going to be that vessel of clay and of iron, or are you going to cleanse yourself and become that vessel of gold, silver, bronze, some valuable material that's useful in service to God? And He places it upon the individual. And this is kind of where I think we avoid and shy away from God and His sovereignty, because the Calvinists take this idea of God's sovereignty and they say, well, everything that you do is because that was God's plan, and you're only doing it because that's what God intended. And so we kind of shy away from this idea that God is involved in our life and that God is, His sovereign plan is going to be what's accomplished. But God does work providentially. But at the same time, the choice is up to us. And I think to the book of Esther, whenever Mordecai is there and saying, you know, you have an opportunity to influence the king to save your people. You remember what he tells Esther? Because she's kind of on the fence. She says, I don't know. If I go before the king, I'm going to get killed. He says, if you don't do it, you know, somebody's going to do it. God's will is going to be accomplished. The Jewish people are going to be preserved. Now, you can either choose to be perhaps the tool in which God accomplishes that, but if you don't worry about that. Somebody else will do it. So God's sovereign plan is going to be accomplished. We have to decide, are we going to be on God's side? Are we going to be a vessel for God? Are we going to be a vessel working against God? So, but absolutely, God was involved here all throughout the book of Daniel. We're going to see that repeated over and over. Okay, verse 5, the king appointed for them, that is these four young men, he appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. So unlike the commoners, these young men would have received daily provisions from the king's table. We don't know the specific food that was placed before them. That's really not important. There were some Babylonian records that were found that talked about Jehoiachin. You may remember Jehoiachin, also known as Jeconiah, also known as Coniah, who was king before Jehoiakim, who was taken to Babylon and pretty much put in slavery there. Some records were found where said Jeconiah, the king of the Judeans, received various rations, and the rations he was receiving was oil and barley. But we know from this text that Daniel and his friends, as well as these other wards of the king, receive some sort of daily provision that involved meat, because that's one of the complaints that they have against the food that they're being fed, is that they don't want to eat any of the meat or drink any of the wine that the king is going to provide for them. It's 3 years of training. This is where they're going to be taught about the language of the Chaldeans. They're going to be taught about their history. These influential young men, they're trying to take them and they're trying to shape them and make them into full-blown citizens of Babylon, so that they might incorporate them into society for the purpose of standing before the king. Now, can you imagine the pressure that's on these young men? I mean, one, mom and dad aren't around. They're in a completely new place. You've got here the king of the most ruthless and powerful nation in the world seeing to your training, making an investment in you, you're not going to want to let them down. You're going to want to do everything in your power to toe the line, so you make him mad, he's probably going to take your life. So the pressure that Daniel and his friends are going to be under is extreme. And it's very impressive to see how they deal with the pressure that they face, being young men, being in this place. Verses 6 and 7. For among them, the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. So, whenever you change someone's name, like we see here in this particular instance, and there are other instances in the Bible, there is some significance to that. For one, it could be something as simple as giving them a name that's easier to pronounce in the language that the Babylonians spoke. Yeah, it may be something as simple as that. We come across sometimes people who aren't native to our country, and sometimes their names are hard to say. And so you bring these people in, you're making them Babylonians, you give them a new name, and maybe it's just because you want them to have a name that's easier for you to pronounce in the language that you speak. You know, you go back to Genesis 41 and 45, Joseph was given a new name whenever he was brought into Pharaoh's household, and whenever he was made a vessel of Pharaoh, he was given a new name. In Esther was the name that she was given by the Persians. Her Jewish name was Hadassah. So she's given a new name. And it may be just something as simple as changing to something easier to pronounce, but I've got a feeling that there's more to it. We'll talk a little bit about that, and apologize I didn't change slides up there. But let's stop for a minute and think about this question, question 7. List both the Hebrew and Babylonian names of Daniel and his three friends. So we know, as we read, the Hebrew names, but let's take a few minutes to discuss that. Okay. Okay. And if you think about the Jewish society, things like this were very significant and very important to them. And so by taking them and changing their name, he could be trying to, once again, I think it's all a part of this. They're trying to ingrain them into this Babylonian captivity. And what I did, I guess I changed the question. I initially thought that I asked, you know, what was the name and what was the interpretation of the name, both of the Hebrew and then what their name was changed to, that is the Chaldean name that they were given. Was that, I don't have a copy of the questions. Did I include that? I just asked what the names were. You're off the hook then. Okay. These are the Hebrew and the Chaldean names, the names that they were changed to, and these are, as best scholars can estimate, the interpretation of what these names were. Now, names were significant in the Old Testament. Seriously, so much more than the significance of names are today. I couldn't tell you what my name means, but you can go back and you can go look at the Old Testament. You see the names that people had, and oftentimes the name that they were given would personify their personality, their nature, the way they acted, their character. And so names played a very big role in the Old Testament. Daniel, his name meant, or was interpreted, God is my judge. Another possible interpretation I came across, and this is kind of interesting, is God's judge. You know, if you think about Daniel and the position that he's in, receiving divine revelation from God. Yes, in a sense, God is my judge would have been a common name, but if you think the specific role that Daniel's going to play in Babylonian captivity, he's the mouthpiece of God for his people and to these people, these Chaldeans, these heathens. And so in a sense, he is almost playing a role like he is God's judge. That is, he's pronouncing various events that are going to come. Later on in the book, he's going to pronounce judgment on King Nebuchadnezzar, and essentially God's judgment on King Nebuchadnezzar for his pride. So kind of interesting to consider, whichever of those it may mean, you could fit both of those into Daniel's life. And his name is thus changed to Belteshazzar. And As best we can understand that, that means he who Baal favors. Now, you may remember that the primary god of the Babylonians was Marduk. But later through time, and I think even by this point in time, Marduk was referred to as Baal. That is, not B-A-A-L, like the gods of some of their enemies past, but B-E-L. And so by changing his name to he who Baal favors, they're trying to erase their religious identity as well. You know, Daniel is talking about his very name reminds him, you know, God is my judge. And I serve Yahweh. I serve Jehovah. And Nebuchadnezzar understands the attachment to those names. And so he just completely says, you're not Daniel anymore. You know, you're now Belteshazzar. That is, he who Baal favors. One of the Babylonian gods. So you can see the strategy and the purpose of him changing their names like that. Hananiah was one of the three men that was taken over, one of Daniel's three friends. And his name, Yahweh has acted graciously. So his name is changed from Yahweh has acted graciously to Shadrach, the command of Aku. And Aku was one of the moon gods, or the moon god, I should say. He was son of Marduk, according to the Babylonians. And so he would have been a powerful and influential god in Babylonian society. And so you got Hananiah, his name is changed from Yahweh's acted graciously to the command of Aku, that is the moon god. Mishael, who is like God? And his name is changed to Meshach. Best they can interpret that, it means I am slighted. However, there have been some scholars who have suggested that it's a variant form of one of the Babylonian gods called Mithras. So, once again, they're all taking these religious names, these religious Jewish names, and pointing them toward their Babylonian gods, their Babylonian religion, the new religion that they want these young men to accept and to serve. And then lastly, Azariah means Yahweh has helped, and it's changed to Abednego, that is, servant of Nabu. And he was the god of wisdom and the god of writing. Probably going to be some of the administrative tasks that some of these young men would be given. So they're changing them from these Jewish gods, the Babylonians, to the gods of the Chaldeans. And you do this, you change someone's name, you're demonstrating a serious authority, a serious power over someone else. And you know, even in the simplest sense, you know, someone calls you a name. They do that for the purpose of demonstrating their power over you, to demean you, to make you less than you actually are. And there are other instances we talked about a couple where Joseph and Esther were given new names. You go back and read about Jehoiakim, who we read about in verse 1. Well, his original name, his Hebrew name, was Mattaniah. But it was changed to Jehoiakim whenever King Nebuchadnezzar, I believe it's whenever Pharaoh Necho came in and made a vassal of him before Nebuchadnezzar and his people came in. But it was originally Mattaniah, changed to Jehoiakim. So we see in this instance Daniel and his three friends and these three young men. The Babylonians are wanting to integrate them fully into Babylonian society. And these young men, they didn't have any choice over what their name was going to be called. But what they did have was the choice that Dave kind of referred to earlier, where they were going to allow this new identification, this new designation, this new life, this new destiny that lay before them. Were they going to pursue that as they were given this new name? Or were they going to resist that? Were they going to stay true to their faith? Were they going to stay true to their God? Were they going to just simply allow their name to be changed but not allow their character, their core, who they were, to be changed? It's kind of interesting that among these, we're not told of any more, but we're told that when King Nebuchadnezzar came in, he took a lot of the young men, some of the young nobles, he took a lot of them from Judah. Where are the rest of them? Why don't we read about any more of them in the book of Daniel? Why, whenever we get over to Daniel chapter 2 or 3, and Nebuchadnezzar builds this great big golden statue, and all of the people there bow down, those other Jewish captives, why don't we see more than just Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refusing to kneel before this golden statue? You know, we know that they weren't the only ones taken, but they're the only ones that stood out. They're the only ones that stayed true to their faith, to their God, to their people. There weren't any others that we know about. Otherwise, I believe they'd have been mentioned for us right here. And verse 8 to me is a pivotal chapter. This is, I believe, what separated Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from all of the other young Jews that were taken captive. And it's one of my favorite verses, and I love this verse particularly. I love to talk about this verse with young people because as it directly applies, we're talking about a young man here. We're talking about other young men and his friends. But at the same time, it's a good verse for us as Christians as well to guide us and dictate how we live and the things that we do. Verse 8, Mr. Bonner, Robert, would you mind reading for us? And I think I initially intended to ask you the first question that Buster intercepted. I can understand the confusion. Robert, would you read verse 8 for us, please? Yes, sir. The first part of that verse there really stands out to me. I remember from the New King James. What version are you reading? New American Standard. Okay. You said that what did that first part of verse 5 say? Or verse 8? Made up his mind. Okay. New American Standard says Daniel made up his mind. New King James says Daniel purposed in his heart. Any other translations out there that we might be missing that might give us an idea of this decision that Daniel and his friends are making? Okay, resolve. All of those are good terms that give us an idea of what Daniel and his friends were doing. He purposed in his heart. He made up his mind. He resolved that he wasn't going to allow himself to be defiled with the king's delicacies. If ever there had been a circumstance where someone might have justified compromise, I think you'd be looking at a pretty good case right here. You've got these young men, 14, 15 years old, taken from their parents, taken to this foreign land where their life is going to be constantly probably at threat if they fall into the disfavor of the king. This might be a good time to compromise everything that you've been taught. Just to stay alive. I've got to do this. I've got to worship these gods. I've got to eat this food. I've got to become like these people, like my captives, so that I can live. It would have been easy, especially for young people. It would have been easy for young people to have said, that's just a sacrifice I'm going to have to make. That's just something I'm going to have to do if I want to stay alive. But you know, that's what Daniel and his friends resolved not to do. They made up their mind that they weren't going to be defiled by the king's food. They weren't going to fall under the influence of these heathens. They purposed in their heart that they were going to serve God. And despite everything that stood against them, despite all of the challenges that they faced, they made up their mind that they were going to serve God. That's a good question for us. As we live each day, granted, we're not facing the terrible circumstances they were, but in regard to our faith, have we purposed in our heart that we're going to serve God? Have we made up our mind? Have we resolved, no matter what temptations I may face, no matter what persecutions I may undergo, no matter what circumstance I find myself in, I'm making the decision right now that I'm going to serve God. So whenever I'm standing at the crossroad of temptation, I don't have to make a spur-of-the-moment decision. I don't have to wonder, okay, what are the consequences of this action if I choose to do it? My mind's made up. Way back here at the beginning, I already made up my mind. And so when I'm there at the crossroad of indecision, I actually know what I'm going to do. You know, that's what Daniel and his friends did. Before they faced these temptations, before they found themselves struggling, having to make a hard decision, they purposed in their heart what they were going to do. And so when that time came, all they had to do was just follow through with what they had already resolved to do. And I believe that's a good application for us. That's one of the things that I take away. And later we're going to talk a little bit about that when we come to the conclusion of chapter 1. That's one of the things I take away from Daniel, and that's one of the things that I find so impressive about Daniel. And I think that that's a great tool to fighting temptation. It's making up our mind right now. You know, not when we're there in the heat of battle and temptation is very appealing to us, but right now, before I ever reach that point in time, let me purpose in my heart, let me resolve that I'm going to serve God. So whenever I find myself faced with this opportunity, faced with this potential situation where I might give in my sin, the decision has already been made. And I really love verse 8 for that reason. Okay. Yeah, that, and ideally, you know, that's how we deal with that, right? Paul says, you know, flee all appearances of evil. Right, don't go there. I mean, that's ideal, but Daniel and his friends were already there, right? And so, inevitably, we're going to face circumstances in our life where we're going to be tempted. But granted, oftentimes our temptation is a result of decisions, like Dick said, that we make. We make decisions that put us in a situation where now, okay, I've got to choose between disobeying God and obeying God. When the wisest thing I can do is to just make sure I don't get myself in a situation like that. But also at the same time, we're going to have circumstances in our life where temptation is just laid out right there in front of us. Not based off of any particular decision we made, but just a moment of opportunity that Satan uses and tries to take advantage of. And that's how I think we deal with that. And one of the ways we can deal with that and overcome that is to make up our mind prior to that time where we're facing that temptation. Any comments or questions on anything we've talked about this morning? And that can't be done. That can't be accomplished. You can't ingrain a young person with that sort of response Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, and Wednesday nights. That's the job of mom and dad day in, day out. You go back to Deuteronomy 6, and Moses is telling the people, you talk to your children when they lay down, when they stand up, when they go about their way. You make sure that God's word, God's precepts, God's law are always in front of them. Otherwise, they're going to reach a point where that's not ingrained with them. It's not going to be natural for them to choose not to give in and to resist sin. And they're going to find themselves tempted. They're going to find themselves losing those battles. And so that's an excellent point, Dave. You know, that training is something that has to be repetitive. It has to be ingrained in them. And as a result of that, then whenever the time of decision comes, the decision's already been made. Any other comments or questions? We've got a few more things that we want to look at regarding verse 8. We looked at a little bit of the application portion of verse 8, but we'll look a little bit more at the contextual portion of verse 8. So we'll pick up next week with question 8 and with verse 8. So I appreciate everyone's